This is the Diehards.
Sale winds. He fires. Swing and a miss. Strike three. It's over. The Red Sox have won the World Championship.
Tom Brady takes the snap, drops to the knee, and the Patriots have won their sixth Super Bowl title.
The Diehards start now on the Sports Map Radio Network.
Presented by Rocket Mortgage. Need to know what it takes for a home loan to fit your budget and your family? Rocket can.
Live from the O'Reilly Auto Parts Studios, here's Anthony Pepe and friends.
Welcome back to the Diehards on the Sports Map Radio Network. Bobby Krivitsky, Shukri writes, if you like the Islanders, Schadenfreude, or both, then congratulations to you because New York probably put this game and thus this series away on a Brock Nelson goal to make it 3-1 in favor of the home team. And Shukri, we talked about it during the break. The turning point in this game clearly was an egregious missed call when Kyle Palmieri elbows Charlie McAvoy in the face.
I don't know if I'm ready to succeed or concede victory to the Islanders just yet, but I will be the first to tell you that that third goal was, I mean, I'll give credit where it's due. Good, that was a nasty dangle, but goodness grief, like the Bruins at this point, I don't think they're giving up. But to me, what I'm seeing is a team that is deflated, and this Islander team is now, they're just defending, and they're able to get into the Bruins zone easily, and that's been part of the problem, defending their own end, and they're not doing a good job of it to get here in game six.
Yeah, I mean, it's a killer that a huge part of winning a championship in any sport is one part luck and one part being able to stay healthy. So
absolutely,
you look at the Kansas City Chiefs, they were a wagon during the regular season. At one point, people were rightfully asking, can this team go undefeated? They get to the Super Bowl, they don't have either of their two bookends, their offensive tackles, and they can't protect Mahomes. He's running for his life all game. And credit to him for fighting valiantly the whole time, but at no point did you think the Kansas City Chiefs were going to win that game, and
no.
At no point did you think it was indicative of how they looked before that. So it's just a reality here as the Bruins, war of attrition, and they lost on that front. The Islanders have had better puck luck. Stick with us here on the Diehards on the Sports Map Radio Network. We're going to be talking all about the action on the hardwood and looking at some stars who might be on the move. Stick with us on Sports Map Radio Network.
You're listening to the Diehards on the Sports Map Radio Network.
Presented by Rocket Mortgage. Home loans that fit your life. Rocket can.
Live from the O'Reilly Auto Parts Studios, here's Anthony Pepe and friends.
Welcome back to the Diehards on Sports Map Radio Network. Bobby Krivitsky, Shukri writes with you. First hour in the books. And as we talk about the second hour, we've gone deep into the NHL postseason. The Bruins Islanders game is no longer fun for us to talk about. So,
give me a bottle of root beer, please. Thank you.
Yeah, well, let's get some root beer floats in here. We're going to be ignoring the action on the ice unless the Bruins score, of course. Then we reserve the right.
Unless they have a comeback on that mirrors Game 7 of the 2013 first round against Toronto, then.
And they almost did in Game 5, but not in the cards. It's probably not tonight either, to be honest. So why don't we pivot, Shukri?
Sure.
We'll take our minds off it because the NBA postseason is well underway as well. And what happens when teams come up short, like we've seen with the Celtics, for instance, is you've got to ask hard-hitting questions about how much of a shakeup do we need to do now over the course of the summer. And so I think the place that most people look to first and foremost is the Portland Trailblazers.
Great point.
Not as talented as a healthy Denver Nuggets team, but that's not the opponent they went up against. No Jamal Murray, no Will Barton, not even P.J. Dozier there. And they couldn't get it done.
Nope.
With the playing field not completely leveled, but a hell of a lot closer than if those guys were in there. And so if you're Damian Lillard now, do you think that he evaluates the situation and asks out this summer?
This is a great question, and I'm so glad that you brought this up because Damian Lillard is at a point of his career, like, listen, he's a top five player in the NBA. And if you're an NBA listening right now and does not agree with this, then you're not an NBA fan. Like, it's Dame time. There's a reason why that slogan exists. But here's the harsh reality. We've seen this with players who play in smaller markets, and they get to a point in their career where they are one of the top five players in the world, and they are faced with, where do we go from here? Where do I go from here? LeBron, 2010, he played in Clippers during his first stint in Cleveland.
Great example.
He made the decision that was aired on ESPN. He decides to go to a larger market. That is Miami. We all know what happened. Lillard is at that position, and I get that he signed that mega deal, and he's been very loyal to the franchise. But the reality is this. With all the respect to CJ McCollum, I don't think that they have enough to contend for a title in Portland, especially long-term. Because let me give you an actual example. Denver, even though Jamal Murray's out for the playoffs, you're not competing against Denver, the Lakers, when they're healthy. But we're going to see next year, was their run to a title last year a fluke or not? And I get it because of the motivation to win for Kobe. God rest his soul. But the same question that's being asked about Miami applies to L.A. But also, continuing with the West, Phoenix. They're not a one-year hit wonder. Devin Booker is a real deal. So if you're Lillard, you got to really be asking, can I realistically win a title with Portland? And I think the answer to that question is no.
Yeah, I'm with you. There's not a CJ McCollum for someone trade that's realistically available to Portland.
Right.
They're not in great cap spot. They spent two first-round picks to bring in Robert Covington to help them defensively, which is an indictment on Neil Olshey, who seems like he's going to keep his job,
mm-hmm.
where he just misread the situation. Everyone who watches the league knows that Covington is a very good team defender, not as much on the ball.
Exactly. He's not a good ISO defender. And that I think, is one fatal flaw when they brought him in. I'm like, listen, you put him against the Steph Currys of the West or Devin Booker of the West. Heck, no one can defend Luka Doncic. But he's going to fail 7 out of 10 times. And I think at the time I said, listen, as you mentioned, he's a great team defender. But in terms of guarding the best guards in the West,
it's not what he does.
It's not what he does.
And on top of it, at the trade deadline, and I wrote about this for Basketball Insiders when I dissected the impact that Norman Powell was making in Portland, and he's been really good for them.
Yeah, good point.
But their first target was Aaron Gordon, and they didn't have the draft capital to go and get him.
Mm-hmm.
That's the type of defensive, impactful player and rim threat who, even though they signed Derek Jones, it's just a different caliber, where someone who's going to get you more points that way, even though Jones can obviously jump higher, is just one of those where Neil Olshey, on a number of situations, he misread the market. And some of those instances, like when it came to what he brought in Robert Covington to do and the capital that he parted with to bring him to Portland, it was a misread of the market, and it was pretty egregious on Olshey's part. He sticks around. At his press conference a couple of days ago, I don't know if you heard this, but he kind of took some shuttle shots at Dame. He took a lot of shots at Terry Stotts, saying that it wasn't on the roster.
Weak.
It really was
that
cowardly.
Was weak.
And he let whoever the next head coach is going to be, not only do I not have your back as you see me kicking Stotts and is behind on the way out the door,
mm-hmm.
but he also said he doesn't think the roster is going to change much, which is true. But at the same time, you've got to be innovative. You've got to do something because you're back against the wall. And if I'm Damian Lillard, nothing Stott said makes it more appealing to stick around.
If I'm Lillard, I'd leave. Like, oh, really? So you're going to take shots at me when I have done everything that I can. And I've been the team's best offensive player, bar none. And you're gonna turn on and do this. So, like, you know what? Keep that same energy. I'm out. So if I'm Dame, and if I'm a Blazer fan, I wouldn't hold it against him if he asks for a trade, because the reality is this. If he stays in Portland, he's not winning a title. Not with the heavily stacked Western Conference that I think is only going to get better next season. You know, I can give you five teams right off the bat that I think they're going to be contenders again next season. The Lakers, the Suns, the Utah Jazz. I mean, I would even say Dallas to an extent. Shocker. Ooh, oh my God, are you crazy? Not so much. But also, not to be outdone, If, and I do mean if, you have a healthy Klay Thompson, Golden State could very well return back to relevancy. So if it's a, if Damian Lillard stays, I don't think he's winning a title.
I think at that point, if he stays, it's not about winning a title. I think it's looking around saying, I have the keys to the franchise. They'll do anything I want. It's a great situation for me, aside from the fact that I can't go get the Larry O'Brien trophy here. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to stick around. I want to spend my entire career at this point, is the decision I've settled on, if you're Dame, with one organization. We know he's as loyal as they come.
Yeah.
So if he stays, I think that's the calculus. Another aspect of this, another layer, if you will, that stands in the way of Dame wanting to come back is the reality that his first choice, he put it on the record, he didn't just go to the front office, was Jason Kidd to be the next head coach. And I think I'm going to tread lightly. Yeah, I think it's one of those where players love great players. And you get that. And look, if Jason Kidd, I think that he's matured as a head coach during his time as an assistant with the Lakers. But how can you really get a read on that? Even if it's not the case, the most important thing is talent. So if Jason Kidd is still a mediocre head coach, but stars want to come to Portland to play for him and team up with Dame, it's worth bringing him on board. The problem is that Jason Kidd does have, as a red flag in his history, an issue of domestic violence. And as a result, Blazers fans, in a sign of integrity, I'd say, have made it very clear where they stand on the prospect of hiring Jason Kidd. And I believe that's the reason why Jason Kidd withdrew his name from the running. Because it doesn't make sense to come out and say that, because they've already stamped it as you're the favorite, you're the guy that the star player wants, that he doesn't think that would be fair to the hiring process. That just doesn't pass the smell test.
Not at all. And you if you were to go ahead and make that hire of bringing Jason Kidd and being the head coach of the Portland Trailblazers, can you imagine the PR that would come along with it? Bad PR, both locally but especially now on a national level. Like, oh, congratulations, you hired a woman beater, a wife beater at that. So, oh, no worries. You can have a checker pass, and we'll bring you on to be the head coach. No big deal. We'll ask you to be the great leader of men. Although you like to, you know, get your Muhammad Ali on with your wife, but what I also see is that the Portland Trail Blazers are at a crossroads in which that they recognize that, listen, you have your marquee guy in Damian Lillard. But you had a great season from Carmelo Anthony as well. You took a gamble, and it paid off. You're not asking him to be the Carmelo Anthony that he was when he was with the New York Knicks. But what you were able to get out of him coming off the bench was more than good enough and more than what you could have asked for. So I think that the Trailblazers, if they're going to be looking to bring in a head coach, because they are among the key teams that is looking for a new head coach this offseason, including the Boston Celtics, I wholeheartedly believe that they need to consider talking to Sam Cassell. I think that he would be perfect for the Portland job.
Yeah, Sam Cassell is someone who the issue right now, if you want to call it that, is there's more than 30 individuals deserving of becoming a head coach. So Sam Cassell has certainly put in the time, has the respect around the league, and deserves the opportunity. I can't say right now that I would bank on him getting one of these jobs that comes available because there's so many good assistant coaches who you can say the same thing. Not all of them played like he did, and certainly not all of them were his caliber of player. Mm-hmm. But it's just one of those realities. And then you look at someone like my top choice for the Celtics is Kara Lawson. So she's not even in that pool.
I'm on that same train with you.
There we go. She's not even in that pool of qualified assistant coaches right now. So I would love to see Sam Cassell get a job.
Yeah.
Whether it happens is a mystery just because the pool is so deep right now. And when it comes to Dame's running mate, C.J. McCollum, is this the time for Portland to look around and say, we can't run it back, but real quick, Shoe, as we're up against a break here, is this the time to trade C.J. McCollum?
I think so, and get a gauge for what you can get back in return. I think if they were to trade him now while his value is still high, that would be huge for the Portland Trail Blazers for the next few years.
Plenty of stars who could be on the move this summer as well. Plenty of NBA matchups to dive into. So stick with Shukri and I, Bobby Krivitsky, here on the Diehards on Sports Map Radio Network.
This is the Diehards on the Sports Map Radio Network.
Presented by Rocket Mortgage.
Live from the O'Reilly Auto Parts Studios, here's Anthony Pepe and friends.
The rundown has been scrapped, temporarily at least. Welcome back to the Die Hard Sports Map Radio. Bobby Krivitsky and Shukri writes. We're talking during the break. And Shu, you said to me, you've got a lot of thoughts on Nikola Jokic winning MVP. All we know is that the two of us don't see eye to eye on this one. Mm-hmm. So why don't you kick us off? What are your thoughts on that decision, that announcement?
Number one, I have been a big proponent of Joel Embiid winning MVP. With all due respect to Nikola Jokic, and I brought this point up a little while ago, that there's only been now two big men to win NBA MVP in the last 25 years. Before Nikola Jokic, guess who the other one was? Shaquille O'Neal.
Yeah. Diesel.
2000. I wholeheartedly felt that Joel Embiid, considering, now, let's go back a year ago at this time. The Sixers, they fired Brett Brown after the colossal disaster that was that series against the Celtics. They fired Brett Brown. They bring in Doc Rivers. And one of my major question marks was, if they're able to at least bring in Rivers, can they figure out how to get the best out of Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons? Rivers has had a profound impact on Embiid. We saw things from Embiid this season that has never been done. And even at times that Ben Simmons can't fire a freaking stick through a damn basketball hoop like his life depended on it. But you got consistent effort offensively and defensively, night in and night out, from Joel Embiid. I get that he's a forward and not a center like Jokic is, but still, the impact of play that he brought forth was noticeable when he missed time with injury. If you remember, without Embiid, the Sixers were good, but they were not great. And I think that Joel Embiid should have been named MVP. And I think it's damn criminal that he's only got, what, one vote? One vote for MVP. And I'm like, I want to know who are the voters. I like to have a word with you. What did you see this season that led you to believe that Embiid was not more worthy of receiving MVP consideration than he got? Because that was the part that got me mad yesterday.
Yeah, he certainly was worthy of more than one first place vote.
That pissed me off. Like, cause I couldn't. I had to go, and because my brother called me after the announcement, and he was like, "You're not gonna believe that he only got one first place vote." I'm like, "You're joking. There's no way."
And Derrick Rose got a vote.
How?
Apparently, I don't even remember it being announced.
God.
Apparently, there's a collective fan vote, and they're saying that's where Derrick Rose's vote came from. Very suspicious.
Yeah.
Once again, fan vote goes wrong. When it comes to, I'll start with Embiid, I guess, that to start the season, he was the front runner for MVP.
Runaway.
And like you said, the impact of Doc Rivers, the personnel changes where for so long he wasn't hurting teams with his passing. And Daryl Morey, the other guy who came in to help reinvigorate the franchise, mixed up the personnel, got him some shooters. Say what you want about Danny Green, but he's streaky, and when he's going,
yes,
he's going. And Embiid said it. Last year, I didn't trust the guys I was kicking the ball out to. This year, I do. So he's showing it was more about that than about the ability to make teams pay when they double. And so between the impact of Doc Rivers getting the ball in more favorable spots consistently, to him trusting the guys that he's passing to, which raises his impact on the team, mm-hmm, where he's no longer just getting empty calories, Embiid had a phenomenal season. The injury is one of the major components that derailed his case for MVP. Nikola Jokic played all 72 games in a condensed season. It's hard enough to do under normal conditions.
Absolutely.
Even more difficult this time around. Mm-hmm. The other reason that Embiid wouldn't have been my vote for MVP is that Jokic just flat out won it, in my opinion. He ranked first in win shares, box plus minus, and value over replacement player.
Are we using analytics?
We're using analytics, baby, and I'm not done with them. All you need to know about those three advanced metrics people are that they reflect the value and impact of an individual performer, and they compare it relative to the average player. Stick with me here. I'm not done.
No, I'm listening.
He didn't miss. We'll go with simpler statistics. Averaging a triple-double by much, 26.4 points per game, mm-hmm, 10.8 rebounds, and 8.3 assists. So he was racking them up. And like I said, 72 games in that type of season, durability is another reason that Nikola Jokic rightfully won the MVP.
Here's the problem that I have with that. You look at the surrounding cast that he had, that he has, I should say, in Denver versus Philly. Now, I like the move that Daryl Morey made, bringing in Danny Green, and you team him up with Tobias Harris. That's a pretty good guy to kick the ball out to. But then Ben Simmons, with all due respect, and he's such a polarizing figure in Philadelphia. He should not just be a mid-range shooter at 6'10". There's so much more that he could do with that size. And when you look at what Joel Embiid was able to do in terms of generating offense, being a nightmare in the paint with his size, but let's not forget about his long-range shooting, his three-point shooting. Oh, my God. For a 7'1" guy, it was absolutely amazing to watch in terms of now it wasn't just only the post game that he worked on. He also worked on and he got better with the 3-point shooting as well as, you know, his mid-range game. And I felt that at times when the Sixers seemed to have those 3 or 4 games where they were slipping a little bit, he was that guy to get them on the right track. Now, as far as Denver is concerned with Nikola Jokic, this was a debate that raged all season long. Jokic or Embiid? Jokic or Embiid? Jokic is a guy that I looked at and I say, you know what separates him and Shaq? What separates him is his ability to be more of a presence in the paint, something that Denver hasn't had in quite some time. And I felt that there are crucial points in the season in which that Jokic, this was someone that you knew that you weren't going to get 25 points on per game and whatnot. And even at times when Jamal Murray was inconsistent, he stepped up. But Embiid, on the other hand, you had that from day one, even though he missed time with injury. And I feel like that was held against him, but it shouldn't have. But after all, Embiid was that dude in 2021.
Yeah, I don't think that Joker was inconsistent at any point this season. But you talk about the supporting cast. They lose Jamal Murray, and they actually climb from fourth to third in the Western Conference, the more difficult of the two sides. And so I look on down the line at those two rosters, going through them in my head here. And on one side, you're mentioning the names. Ben Simmons, Tobias Harris had a career year.
Yeah.
Doc Rivers seems to be the Tobias Harris whisperer. And he was getting buckets like the Atlanta Hawks owed him money last night. Mm-hmm. He was killing them. And even he had a quiet, I think it was 21 points in game one. So he's been producing. And then you go to Simmons, who's just a defensive stud. And on top of it, with the facilitating and all that, even with the frustration, we're talking about someone who is an all-star, who's an all-NBA caliber player, even if he doesn't get named to it this year. And so there's so much talent there. There's multiple guys on max deals. And in Denver, I talked about what Jokic did without Jamal Murray, but you go down from their second-best player, Michael Porter Jr., he stepped up for sure, but he's a young guy who contributes in one way,
good
scoring.
Point. Yes.
And then you look at the rest of the roster, and it's a bunch of meh. They're fine. I like pretty
they're
much
good,
all of
they're,
them.
They're good
but,
role
but you
players.
You can easily take them or leave them. So I think in terms of who is the stronger supporting cast, it's actually another point in Jokic's favor. I think they got this one right, personally.
I just feel like, okay, like with respect to the Sixers, and maybe just because I did spend a pretty fair amount of time watching on Sixers games this year because I was so eager to see what type of impact would Doc Rivers have on the team, and it's clear, massive. But I do think that Jokic is a guy that we're going to see in the MVP discussions for a year to come for sure.
We've got a lot to talk about with the Sixers and perhaps a look ahead, so stick with us here on the Diehards. You're listening to the Sports Map Radio Network.
You're listening
listening to The Diehards on the Sports Map Radio Network.
Presented by Rocket Mortgage. Home loans that fit your life. Rocket can.
Live from the O'Reilly Auto Parts Studios, here's Anthony Pepe and friends.
Welcome back to The Diehards on Sports Map Radio Network. Bobby Krivitsky, Shukri writes.
Ayo!
We talked about the Sixers and Joel Embiid, his case for MVP against Nikola Jokic's. Now let's talk about Philadelphia as a team. They played last night against the Atlanta Hawks, evened up the series. And to me, I thought the biggest difference in this game compared to game one is that Philly went from Danny Green mostly matching up with Trae Young in the first matchup, that series opener, to putting Ben Simmons on him majority of the time.
Ooh,
and then
yeah.
ramping up how much Matisse Thybulle got on him when it wasn't Simmons. And on top of that, they realized, we've got to pick Trae Young up as soon as he crosses half court.
You know what's interesting? Here's the difference between, and this is, I think what I'm about to say is about to come to a focal point of our discussion. This is the difference between the Sixers and the New York Knicks. The Sixers, they have defenders that can guard Trae Young. You saw the difference in terms of the adjustment that they made from game one to game two. Making that switch has made a world of a difference. And I think in a situation like this, you need guys with length that can guard guys like Trae Young, who could beat you with his quickness. He's obviously got the long-range shot and the mid-range jumper, but I do think that limiting him to a half-court game is part of the key of slowing him down. Because what the Knicks were not able to do was slow him down in that regard. He was, at points, able to dominate full court, you know, going from end to end, whether if he was driving in the paint or dishing out to the key and whatnot. What you're seeing now with Philadelphia is saying, hey, we're not gonna give you that luxury. We got guys that can defend. Ben Simmons, Joel Embiid, great defender. And as you mentioned, Danny Green, very underrated. And I think at times, we don't talk about how good of a defender Danny Green is, going back to when he was in San Antonio.
Yep.
Like, and I think part of the reason why that he was brought here was for this purpose. You got an elite guard like Trae Young. You put in Danny Green. You see what you're able to do there and make the adjustments as necessary. And I think it was definitely a brilliant move on the part of Doc Rivers in this situation.
And it's absurd to watch Joel Embiid, who's the modern Hakeem Olajuwon.
Oh, yeah.
And he's even bigger than Dream. But Ben Simmons, it is equally as absurd that someone his height has the foot speed to keep up with Trae Young and to cut off driving lanes from someone who's so small and shifty and such an elite ball handler.
Yeah.
But Simmons did a great job. Thybulle stepped it up compared to how he performed in that role in game one. They started switching more to make sure there were bodies on Trae when they ran screens to try and free him up. Coming, you know, as soon as he crosses half court, that's one of those actions that the Hawks love to give him real estate to work with. And Philly said, we can't give it to you,
or
we're going down. So they did a great job with that. So Young, he had 35 in game one. He dropped that down to 21 in game two. He's 1-for-7 from beyond the arc. So Philly, credit to Doc Rivers for those adjustments. And, of course, the guys who went out there and executed. And it actually extends beyond Trae Young, Shu, where as a team, the Hawks took 21 less threes in game two. That's one more than the amount they made in the series opener.
That's a great point, because I think part of it is the Hawks' game is predicated on hitting those three-pointers. They are, as I like to say, the Golden State Warriors of the East in that regard. I'm not saying that Trae Young is a Steph Curry or a Klay Thompson. That's not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying is, this is a team that throughout the season at times you've seen they live and die at the three-pointer, at the three-point line. And what you saw was a team that lost confidence in making those shots from the three-point line as the amount of attempts from the three-point line went lower, as you mentioned, from game one to game two. I think it was a byproduct of who was guarding along that three-point line. You got guys like Tobias Harris and as well as Danny Green, as we talked about, being solid defenders. I think a lot of it has to do with, oh, my God, they've taken away the three-pointer. So how do we try to penetrate in the paint to create contact and to go to the foul line? And I think that's something that Atlanta has struggled with up until this point so far.
Yeah, they have. They did a great job of it in game one. And it's funny to watch Sixers fans complain about Trae Young drawing fouls, mm-hmm. and Hawks fans complain about Joel Embiid doing it. It's just, it's a reality that both sides are going to have to deal with throughout this series because they're both masters at it. Trae Young is Harden-esque to me,
yeah.
and Embiid also elite when it comes to getting to the foul line. It was funny to me that in the middle of, I believe it was the first quarter, maybe it was the second.
It was the second quarter.
Well, so of game one, mm-hmm. they come back from a break, and they give us this Wired for Sound clip of Doc Rivers telling the team, no more turnovers. We've got to cut down on them. And immediately after that, three consecutive turnovers. And that was one of those Achilles heels that clipped the Sixers in game mm-hmm. one. They had 19 in the opener. Last night, it was 7. So it's just a dramatic difference for Philly. And I always caution, don't overreact to game one. Even if the road team comes in and blows them out, don't get carried away. And so for Philly, when you look at the adjustments on Trae Young, when you look at them taking care of the ball and responding to Doc Rivers' coaching, even though it took some time to marinate,
oh yeah,
I still remain unconvinced that the caveats like Joel Embiid's knee, so health and all that apply, but I just don't believe, even with what happened in the opener, that the Hawks are going to come out of this series.
I don't think so either. And my big thing is this. Game ones in the NBA has always been a feel-out game. Let me feel you out. Let me size you up in terms of what scheme are you going to try to run. Are you going to try to implement a trap defense where you're going to try to clog up the lane in front of the basket and so forth? Or are you a good perimeter defending team? Like, things along those lines. So what you saw in game one, I didn't expect to transfer into game two because I said to myself, listen, if I'm Doc Rivers, and I noticed it in game one, whereas I feel like Doc Rivers is not using Ben Simmons correctly in terms of defending, not offensively, but defending. Because, listen, Trae Young is the focal point of this Atlanta Hawk offense, where he's a great facilitator of the basketball. He could create shots and so forth. But here's a mismatch. Sixers got length. You talk about guys like Tobias Harris, Danny Green. What's their height? They're averaging what? It's like 6'8", 6'9", 6'10". Ben Simmons, 6'10". Like, those things matter against a smaller guard like Trae Young, in which that you have to keep him away from that three-point line. Make him drive to the paint and create those fouls. And as you mentioned, Hawk fans complaining about Joel Embiid going to the line, but here's the reality of the situation. If you are going to take away one aspect of a team's strength, you have to be able to at least be able to. Did it just score again?
No, that's two.
That's two. No way.
It's not deja vu. That's a replay of the second goal.
You
have to forgive him because it was almost.
I was about to say, like, did he score again?
In the Pepe compound, it was almost just 4-3, but it is 4-2 still.
Oh,
that was a replay.
Screw you, NBC. You're such a tease.
If you had looked over here, I would have held up the two sign, but I don't.
Just
checking in as they're showing a replay of a goal and wondering.
Oh my God! But to finish up my point, so here we are with the Sixers, and I think that they're at a point now where they recognize they are the superior team defensively. Offensively, I mean, it's not really much of a comparison, but I do think defensively they have the players to be able to come in, and not to forget about Thibault as well. Like he is, I think, going to be the wild card for the Sixers in this series. Especially defensively, young player, second year in the league, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Thibault, I think it's three.
Third year in the league. So I do think that the Sixers, I still expect them to win the series in six games, if anything.
Yeah, I think that sounds about right. And so we think the Sixers are going to win. If you have a different take with what I'm about to say, I would love to hear it. I would say we know the Brooklyn Nets are going to beat the Milwaukee Bucks. You with me on that or not?
No, I am. Here's my reason why. To the fine folks of Wisconsin, you can curse me out on Twitter at Shukri Writes, but Giannis Antetokounmpo is a choker. He's a playoff choker. He's a playoff choker. Listen, you have had now how many postseasons? Let's go back to 2018, 19, 20, and now this year. You get to the second round, and your best player has failed you repeatedly in consecutive postseasons. You realize in the Giannis Antetokounmpo era in Milwaukee, he's only played in the East Finals, what, once against Toronto. I was 19. That's it.
And that's one of those you talk about these playoff shortcomings. They were up, I believe it was two games to nothing.
Yes, correct.
And then
correct.
The series flipped. Mm-hmm. So with Giannis, if you want to say choker, especially in the sports radio industry, I'm cool with it. I would say that it's the reality of his shortcomings and why he's a top-tier superstar, back-to-back MVP.
No question.
But the list of guys who you can win a championship with as the best player on your team is even shorter, and he's not on that roster. He's someone who he's not much in the way of a facilitator, and he's not going to pull up and hit jumpers from mid-range, which is where the defense, that's what they give you
exactly.
Come playoff time, especially in the crunch. So Giannis, top-tier superstar, not the guy that I want as the captain when I'm looking to win titles and build around, as great as he is. So I think what Milwaukee's running into, and look, right now he's having trouble scoring on Blake Griffin. That's just unacceptable.
Which is absurd, because Blake Griffin, in my opinion, he's an inferior defender. Like, you should have no problems with Blake Griffin. Now, if you sat here and told me that he would turn around and have problems against the likes of LaMarcus Aldridge before he retired and whatnot, then that's one thing. But Blake Griffin, Blake Griffin is not the Blake Griffin of old when he was with Los Angeles and so forth. But for a team like Brooklyn, that is not predicated on defense. Let's just be honest.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, we could sit here and talk about their big three and so forth, and their supporting cast.
It's not what makes them great. It's not on the defense. It's the offense.
But that's part of the reason why I'm a bit more harsher with Giannis, because this is not a great defensive team. They have not been a great defensive team all year long. You should not have this much trouble being able to produce offensively, especially on a level in which that you're able to carry a team. Now, this is not to excuse Chris Middleton at all, but I expect more out of him. I just do. I feel like there are times where I watch him play, he produces, but if one guy is Giannis, is not producing at a level that you're used to seeing him produce in a regular season, you expect the other guys to be able to, like, step up, but you're just not getting that right now.
Yeah, across the board, their guys are not performing up to expectations, and so I do think it sounds like you agree with me that the Nets are moving on. Right? And so if it's Brooklyn and it's Philly, two of the three heavyweights left in the East, what's your expectation for that series?
It's going seven.
I hope so.
But as far as who makes it out, I think that series, if that is to be, could very, very well determine the legacies of both franchises for the next several years. Philadelphia, because the year that they've had with Embiid and Simmons and all the questions entering this season, whether if the Sixers can truly get to the finals with those two centerpieces at the centerpiece of your franchise, and then Brooklyn, you go out and you make the trade for James Harden, and you started the season with so much expectation with Kyrie and KD coming back healthy, but the team that would have the most to lose is Brooklyn, no question. Because after when they made the acquisition for James Harden, I said this the day of, if they don't get to the finals, this is the ultimate disappointment in the history of the NBA, because you've invested so much into this season. Now you'll get those guys again next season as well, because they're all still under contract for another year, if not longer. But the reality is, for this season with this team, it would be absolutely disappointing if the finals do not come to Barclays Center.
I mean, I just think they are. It's their championship to lose, and as long as they stay healthy, I fully expect them to hoist the Larry O'Brien Trophy. We've got more NBA playoff matchups to dissect, so stick with us here. You're listening to the Diehards on the Sports Map Radio Network.
This is the Diehards on the Sports Map Radio Network.
Presented by Rocket Mortgage.
Live from the O'Reilly Auto Parts Studios, here's Anthony Pepe and friends.
Welcome back to the Diehards on Sports Map Radio Network. Bobby Krivitsky, Shukri Wrights. We're here to put a bow on tonight's edition of the show. And so I want to start with Jazz Clippers real quick, Shu. Mm-hmm. Kawhi logs 42 minutes in both of the final two matchups that the Clippers had with Dallas. For Paul George, it was 36 straight minutes in Game 6 of that series, 46 minutes total. Then in Game 7, he follows it up. He plays 43 and a half minutes. That was 2 days later. Another 2 days later is last night's Game 1 against the Jazz. So him and Kawhi, they struggle from the floor. 23 points for Leonard and Paul George. He had 20 points. Neither of them shot efficiently from the floor. Utah didn't have Mike Conley, though, and they get the win. So what is more concerning to you? The idea that the Clippers were in it all the way down to the final shot of the game without their top two guys playing well, or the idea that the Jazz could win without Mike Conley?
The fact that the Jazz can win without Mike Conley, and for me, I feel like we've gotten to a point with the Clippers where it's like when the Clippers feel like they have something to prove, that they'll actually go out and prove it. But when like there's nothing to play for, it's as if like, oh, all bets off, we're done.
For Shukri Wrights, I'm Bobby Krivitsky. We appreciate you sticking with us here tonight on the Diehards. Hope you enjoyed the show. We'll be back from 8 to 10 tomorrow night. Stick with us here on the Sports Map Radio Network.